I'm speaking with Matt McMahon live in the studio tonight.
Those things sort of get me pretty busy, but I also play with Phil Slater and Simon Barker and, you know, all the various people that I, you know, Steve Hunter's band, we've been playing a bit, play with Guy Straz, you know, lots of different things. So it all adds up to sort of being, you know, being reasonably busy if you just keep working away at these little things.
Are there any particular highlights in those 6 years that stand out for you? I know you've been busy with Joseph and Vince.
Yeah, well, we had a great time with Joseph last year in New York. Got a chance to record in New York with Christian McBride and Mike Stern, so that was a real thrill. You know, heard those guys on recordings for a long time, and it was a real pleasure to meet them and get a chance to make music with them. And just, it's always, you always listen to those people and you know they're great, but when you actually play with them, you realize on another level the listening that they do. And you know, I guess all the great musicians are like this. So they're not into grandstanding; they're into supporting the music and making a great dialogue happen, you know. So it felt very welcoming and very, you know, it was very, very easy to play with him. It was great.
So sometimes there's a possible tendency to say, well, we put a lot of these people on pedestals from New York. You think there's a, you know, when you're exposed to great musicians like that, there's some merit in that, do you think? Or?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. I think there's fantastic musicians here that I play with all the time. So, you know, a trumpet player like Phil Slater, who I play with a lot, I sort of forget, because I know him so well and played with him so much, I forget how good he is. And then every now and then I have to remind myself just in every way, playing the instrument, his great conception of music. And so, yeah, look, there's extraordinary players here. But there's another thing, I guess, too, when you hear someone like Mike Stern, like, I mean, I grew up listening to Miles Davis records with him on it. So it's sort of, it's embedded in the history in another kind of way, you know. So it's not just a great guitar player. It's like that's that certain sound that's helped to define kind of a certain thing. So you sort of kind of familiar with it in a way, you know.
It's broadly influential.
It is.
Right across many lands.
It is. So, yeah, so that's great. I mean, and just the level of musicianship is incredible. I mean, that's not the be-all and end-all, of course, of music in the end, you know. You want to go for music that touches you. But it is pretty incredible. Was it pretty incredible to play with Christian McBride and see his level of his playing and what he can read and what he can handle and how quickly he can interpret music, you know, get a lead sheet for something and not fumble, but on the very first take he's being creative, he's making decisions, he's setting things up, you know. So just that raw ability is humbling, you know, when you're around it. But as I say, it's not intimidating because it's helping you all the time.
He received tremendous accolades when he was here with a trio, I think, a couple of years ago. I described this as a bit of a concept album. Would you agree with that?
Well, it's an interesting question because when I recorded these pieces, as I sort of say on the liner notes, I just had some time in the studio and I recorded some improvisations, not even necessarily with a view to releasing it. I mean, I just wanted to do it and then just as a recording exercise. And then I liked it sufficiently to release it. So they're all tied together by being part of the same
session
and being, you know, being in the same mood. But one of the reason I call it the name that it has is when I listen back to it, you know, when you're deep in the process of improvising, you're not always aware of exactly what it is that you're doing, you know. So you're just concentrating hard. And then on listening back to it, it's kind of interesting to go, right, this is what's happening. This is what it sounds like. And what I detected in there was a little sort of the traces of the Irish music that I'd heard as a child growing up. And there was a lot of that around the house when I was a kid, listening to amongst every other sort of music too, but a lot of Irish music. And it always resonated with me and my brother played it a lot and I loved it. And it just struck me how that is in there, you know, without me trying to produce it or whatever.
So the heritage there is coming out subconsciously in your music.
I think so. And you could say, well, I've played some of that music. I mean, I think when I improvise, I could probably sit down, you know, with a footnote at all and say, oh, that's, you know, that's a little bit of a Herbie Hancock phrase. You know, I've just played so many different pieces and transcribed things and there's so much music that I've sort of absorbed that I love. But hopefully when I'm sit down to play, it's all unconscious. I'm just playing and I'm not really thinking that way about it. So it's sort of in there. So there's everything is in there, all the stuff that I've played, but that Irish music was definitely in there.
Let's just focus on that for a moment. How do you prepare yourself when you're coming into the studio and the purpose is really just to allow the music to evolve? How do you prepare yourself for that moment? artistically, creatively? What are you actually doing mentally and physically to prepare yourself for that series of creative sessions?
Well, I think one thing, like these recordings were done. Well, I sort of did a trio recording, which I actually haven't released yet. The plan was to release that first, but and I just stole a couple of hours out of that session. And so my head was very much in this other music, you know, which was more about reading charts and the more sort of more like a jazz recording, I guess. So I was preoccupied with all of that stuff and trying to be accurate with playing things and all that. So in a way, that's kind of a foil to that way of playing, where you just let go of any expectations and I'm getting better at this, but to just sit down and really listen hard to what your brain's telling you. And often when I was a younger musician, it can be a very self-conscious thing when you improvise. You know, I know when I've taught classical musicians for the first time and get them to improvise, it's quite a traumatic experience for them to actually come up with something that's not written. So when I improvise, that can happen. You can become self-conscious and you think, oh, this is too boring, or a better change. You know, you're in the moment trying to create something. And I've learned that if you just are happy to just sit at the piano and have no expectation about anything that comes out, then, you know, things sort of flow better. So I've sort of learned that lesson. Don't think, got to play, I need to contrast this, I need to develop this, I need to stop this. None of it.
Don't overthink it.
No, just try and have no thoughts and just let the fingers and the years of playing that have led up to those moments are influencing, which is, I guess, why I find it interesting that the Irish heritage is in there. Those things are something I have no control over, you know, my ancestors, but somehow they're shaping the music. And I found that to be just a very interesting, and I guess it's like all of our lives and everything we do, isn't it? So many of the things we feel like we're making choices and doing decisions, but from a broader perspective, you could say a lot of these kind of decisions are set up by the things that happened hundreds of years ago that your ancestors did when they, in my case, they travelled from Ireland to here, and so many attitudes and so many things have grained in there. You know, we sort of simultaneously a product of all these things that have come before us, and at the same time we're alive now trying to muddle our way through life, you know.
That's right. The Voyage of Mary and William, now, they came out in the 1800s, didn't they?
They did, 1847, yeah. Okay, from Tipperary. So, and of course, you know, as you know, when you go back, you have two parents and four grandparents and eight great-grandparents and so on. So there's a wave of relatives that we know came up. But these are the earliest ones we have records of in 1847. But there's other waves of our other sides of the family who came out in sort of 1860 and then 1880, things like that.
This really is a journey, and you can sort of picture at every stage of the journey, you know, these pieces. But Tempest Within, what are we trying to focus on there?
Well, it's probably the most turbulent piece on the album. And I kind of thought, one can only imagine being on a ship, you know, and the survival rates weren't great on those ships, as you can expect coming in the 1840s. A storm at sea would have been a terrifying experience, so it's sort of encapsulating that. But I also figured that one can only imagine, you know, all I know is very sketchy details of these relatives, but one can only imagine what turmoil they went through on this journey. So it's sort of simultaneously looking at maybe a tempest at sea and also kind of churning and stresses that would have been going on inside as they were travelling over.
I wanted to ask you what other interests that you have besides music.
Well, I like reading. So, yeah, I like reading a lot.
Well, what have you read recently?
I've been really reading the poems of Emily Dickinson, if you want the truth. Yeah, I studied her. Actually, I don't think I studied her that much at university, but I've always found her to be a fascinating character. You know, she was born in 1830 in America and lived in Massachusetts and lived a very reclusive life, particularly towards the end. And basically, you know, she corresponded with people, but she didn't go out much, but she left this legacy of 1,800 poems in her room that her sister, you know, she told her sister to burn all her letters and burn things, so she burned the letters, but she didn't burn the poems. And so, you know.
So they were published later on?
They were published after her death, yeah. A couple were published early, a couple here and there, but of course no one took much notice, you know, but then she sort of, I guess, now come to be one of the great sort of poets. She's got a beautiful, almost a childlike quality to it, like a sing-song, but a lot of her poems are about immortality and death, and, you know, it's kind of a mismatch between this sing-song kind of tone and then it's very profound and beautiful, beautiful stuff. So, yeah, I love that. Yeah. And another interest I've got into in the last 6 months is swimming.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I've always swum in the pool to do a few laps to keep fit. But actually, Emma Pask, I was doing a gig with Emma one night, and she said, "Why don't you come and swim across Bondi Bay with us tomorrow? We're going to go across." So I did, swimming from the south side over to the north and back, and I was just totally hooked. So it's just such a great way to swim, swimming out through the waves and out in the beautiful ocean. And I've been trying to go as many times a week as I can since then.
Obviously a pretty good swimmer to be able to do that. I mean,
yeah, I mean, you build up to it. I mean, when I got back into swimming a few years ago, I'd just do 5 laps in the pool, and then I sort of got up to 10 laps, and then the next thing I could do 20, and then I might do a few more. And this is about probably 1.7 Ks, I guess, over and back. But, you know, you just, like all these things, you just build up to it. I've done a couple of, you know, maybe 3.5K swims, you know, in that time. So, and things like swimming, there's the Palm Beach to Whale Beach swim was held a month or so ago, and Bondi to Bronte, they have these big organized swims. So doing those when I can too, you know. It's often hard on the weekends. I'm often playing, so I can't do it. But, yeah, I'm just totally hooked on it.
That's great. What about the Sydney scene now, or the scene here in Australia generally? What are the largest barriers inhibiting the live music scene, do you think?
Oh, it's a hard question. I mean, I think the live music scene is very healthy, like as healthy as it's been in a long time. I mean, the huge thing is the changing of the entertainment and liquor laws a few years ago under the huge efforts of lots of people, particularly John Wardle, good Sydney guitarist, who really made it his mission to make it easier for venues to open. And then hence 505 became, you know, a legal venue. And then we've since had Foundry 616. And there's just other small bars around the place that are having music. So that's great. People can get a gig and play a bit more than they ever could. And I remember back about 10 years ago when it was pretty hard. I mean, Jazz Groove had a gig on a Tuesday night that young musicians could do. SEMA had performances on Fridays and Saturdays. And there'd be a few pubs around doing things. But it was less, you know, there's definitely much more going on now. So in terms of barriers, I mean, I think at every level, you know, I think if there was more support, you know, in general, in the media, you know, I was just saying to someone this morning, actually, I grew up and I learned a lot about it by watching ABC television. I saw Mike Nock, Dale Barlow, Don Burrows, James Morrison regularly on the television on a Sunday afternoon or other nights. And then there were documentaries on Miles Davis. There was Johnny Griffin live at the Basement. So I saw him, you know, I just flicked on the TV. I remember being at home as about a 14-year-old. My parents were out or something, and I just turned the television on and Johnny Griffin was playing, and I didn't know what it was, but I just was mesmerised, you know.
And Jonathan Zwartz had an ABC series as well, didn't he?
He did. The Poles, that was in about 1999, I think. Mm. So, yeah, so, but there's less of that. And I think, of course, in this digital age, I mean, the ABC recently and some of these cuts that have happened have lost Jazz Track where it's used to broadcast. And people would argue, well, in the digital age now, people can access jazz if they want. There's now dedicated stations and you can do that. But I think the ABC has a vital role in not just playing it, but contextualizing it and making, in the way that Countdown did, I mean, easy show to produce, really. Bands want to play. You just get a guy with a quirky guy with a hat and interview people, and it's a no-brainer to me. So, of course, this program's fantastic, and as you know, I'm involved in community radio on another radio station.
We call our sister radio station.
There you go.
Eastside.
That's right. So yeah, I mean, and I've been extremely fortunate. I'm busy playing, and I think you just sort of, I had a chance to interview Dave Holland, actually, on my radio program a few years ago, and he was just sort of saying when he was a young musician, you know, Ronnie Scott would let the young guys come and play in there. You know, it was the same story. There's never enough venues. There's never enough opportunities, but you just got to make them. You know, you have to be enterprising and try and find them if you really want to play, you know. So you have to take that attitude. If you want to start sort of going, oh, it's all, there's barriers in the way, there's too many barriers. If you're going to think like that, you might as well give up.
So as a piano player, what would be the one thing you'd change in the Sydney jazz scene if you could?
As a piano player. Well, look, I must say there's some good pianos around. I mean, for a long time, you know, playing either no piano or not a very well-maintained instrument. But if you go to 505, they look after it. If you go to the Sound Lounge, they look after it, and Foundry. So, look, things are immeasurably better. I'd love to see a piano in every venue, you know. And be great if there were, but it's sort of wishful thinking, isn't it, you know.
Have you played the local venue here, VJ's?
I have. Well, that's another one that's got a nice piano, you know. and it's a great venue.
So I think that was the piano that was used to be at the old Sidon.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. That's right. So yeah, it's got a bit of history to that piano too. When I play it, I can almost remember those days when I hear it, because they all have their own flavour, these different pianos. As I say, that things have, you know, it's always got its challenges if you want to be involved in the arts, and you just got to be part of the creativity is trying to find ways to kind of keep doing it.
And of course, there's just so many great piano players now here in Sydney. A lot of them have come from New Zealand. But are the opportunities increasing or decreasing as a result of so many people like Steve Barry and Jackson Harrison and, you know, guys like this that are really, really talented?
That's right. Harry Sutherland's another great young player. You know, there's lots of them. But, you know, everyone's sort of, I guess, the jazz musician life has always been, you know, very few jazz musicians actually play jazz all the time, you know. Even the super greats, like Joe Henderson or whatever, he spent time doing Blood, Sweat and Tears, you know. So people have always done a bit of a theatre show, a little bit of teaching, maybe a few jingles, you know, supplementing. It's kind of an unattainable fantasy, the Miles Davis situation, where you have enough of a following where you can exclusively do your own work, you know, on your own terms. There's not many people these days get that opportunity, and in those days, for that matter, either. But,
well, in Australia, really, there's only probably Mike Nock and James Morrison.
That's right. But so even Mike, you know, he does it, but he's taught at the Con for a long time. You know, he's been involved in many different things, and he's, you know, you talk to Mike about his long career. He did sort of all sorts of different sessions in New York, you know, talking about the Musicians Union working, and you could do, you know, so. And I think it's, you know, you have to be kind of pragmatic about it. Well, you don't have, you can do whatever you like. That's the bottom line. People can be very picky and choosy about the gigs they do. It probably means maybe not all your income will come from your playing, you know, and other people will accept every gig, and maybe once they're just spreading yourself too thin or something. Personally, I feel like I'm extremely fortunate. I get to play music a lot with people that I really like, but I've cultivated that too. I've said no to kind of things along the way that have been maybe good opportunity, but I thought, no, you know, I'd rather do this lower paid thing with these people, because it feels like it's got longevity, and it's with my friends, and it's, you know, so you have to sort of stick to your guns a bit.
Yes.
Well, it depends what, you know, there's just a million choices to make about this, about how to survive in the arts and look for funding and try and get paid from venues and all that stuff that comes up.
An article I read recently, I don't know whether you caught up with this one, but it was to do with the listening habits, I suppose, of younger age groups these days. They rarely listen to complete albums, and they tend not even to listen to a complete song. They might listen to the first 10 seconds, and then if they don't like it, skip to the next one on their device. And streaming is adding to that disposability, I suppose, of the music. It's a fairly radical reduction in the human's attention span. What sort of implications does this have for jazz and improvised music, and if so, what do we need to change?
Well, I guess the forces that are moving in this way are ginormous, and there's nothing, you know, things just change, you know. I guess it's like, I sometimes feel like it's like you're a portrait painter in the 19th century, and suddenly the camera's invented, and then it's up to you. You can go, well, I want to keep painting portraits. Well, I guess there must have been some portrait painters who went, well, I'm getting a camera. You know, and I guess there's room for everybody in those things. So you can kind of, whatever you're doing, you're going to be in the present. You're going to be embracing you're going to be caught in the whatever's happening now. But I think part of being a jazz musician, I mean, you're already miles away from the mainstream. So it's a kind of a nice place in a way. I mean, these trends and listening patterns and things will go, but the people that are sort of hardcore into it are another kind of audience, and they're probably, you know, not as fickle maybe as some other audiences. So part of me kind of feels sad in a way that I know exactly what you're getting at. And I find myself doing the same thing, because I've got my iPod with all my library on and I can just flick around with it. But I try and force myself to just have one CD in the car, you know, so I've just got to listen to that CD for a few days, you know. I think there is a danger that people do not get into music in the same depth. If you've only got one album, you learn it backwards and you can get in there. But look, there's such good musicians coming out now. So in terms of I guess we're sort of talking about the listening habits of the general populace, aren't we? And I think there is a definite sense in which, I feel, in which the respect for and sense of wonder at music is sort of probably not what it once was. It's so available. If you want Beethoven symphonies, you can just get 100 versions of them now. I think about those stories about J.S. Bach walking immense distances to hear Buck Doherty play the organ, or that thing of in a Mozart opera when the audience, if they loved it so much, they clap and clap and they do it again, like just because that was their only chance of hearing it. They're only hearing that opera once, you know.
Yes.
Just the preciousness,
yes.
The ephemeral nature of it, and what it must have, the magicalness of it. Yeah, there's a certain, could say, a bit of sadness about that fact. But I do think you just have to accept that.
Yes.
This is something else that's different, you know.
And it sort of, it follows the, I guess, the way generally that we treat other mediums, even like journalism, for example, in the media. There seems to be so much news available. We tend to skim the surface of a lot of stories, and that dumbs down the actual quality of the content in the media as well.
Yeah, that's right. And there's such a thirst for the newest and the latest all the time, isn't there? That can definitely happen. But I think, you know, jazz can stand for something else. It stands sort of for another thing that's a bit more demanding. It doesn't have to, actually. Well, jazz has got so many guises, hasn't it? There's a 3-minute entertaining version of jazz, which I love too. I mean, a lot of Louis Armstrong songs or something, you know. That's fine. That's great. Then there's sort of maybe more demanding music for the general public, like late Coltrane or something like that. So, and I think it's reflected here in Australia. You know, you think about musicians like Bernie McGann, who's a huge figure in the scene, but not that well known beyond the jazz scene. But in a way, that's something. Someone asked Christian McBride a question. He did a masterclass at the Conservatorium a couple of years ago. It was the day Margaret Miller had died. They just got the news. And someone in the class said to him, you know, do you think it's sad that Margaret is not more well known and not as respected? And Christian said, yes, well, he was such a fantastic musician, you know. But he was saying that other stuff comes at a price too. Like the alternative is that he's on the cover of Who magazine.
Yeah.
You know, and then there's all this frivolous other stuff that goes with that, you know. So you have to be careful what you wish for, you know.
Mm.
And I remember the first time I saw Bernie McGann play in the Forest Lodge Hotel, little room, Roger Frampton, Andy Brown and John Pershaw were playing. And I just thought, this is sort of my scene. It's a back room of a pub. There's not that many people here. But boy, the vibe was incredible. And I thought, well, you know, financially it'd be great if there were 10,000 people there for the band.
Mm.
But for the actual experience of the playing and the listening, I mean, going to a small jazz venue is the best for me. I just love it.
It is, isn't it?
So this is what happens. And this is what happens when Prince or someone comes to town. They do their big show, and then they want to go and play Bennett's Lane or The Basement because they want to have that feeling of playing in the small club after their main gig.
Yeah.
So I guess, of course, I like doing the big show too, but there's another thrill of playing in a small venue to an intimate crowd. And that's kind of partially a feature of the economics of jazz. The music is probably not as mainstream, but it's also one of the beautiful things about it. So
that intimacy, the idea of being able to be so close to the artists as they create, and because it is jazz, they are creating something new. So the idea of being, it's almost like, as you say, watching a painter.
Mm. Yeah.
Matt McMahon, we're going to finish tonight with The Stranger's Land, and obviously this is when Mary and William reach their destination. When you first heard this and you've felt that though this should be the piece that is the final piece on the album, what qualities about this piece of improvisation that led you to believe that this is when they arrived?
It's an interesting one. There's a sort of sometimes when I hear this piece, I hear a little bit of Ravel in there. There's some Ravel piano pieces that I've just played through, not at a super high standard, of course, but play them and enjoy them. And I just felt there was a little bit of that in there. And it just felt a little bit, exotic's not the word, but just a little bit different. And it felt like a kind of a hopeful sort of melody and piece. Some of the others were quite somber in their mood. And this one just had a bit more, I guess there's a strangeness, but a bit of hope in it. I hope now that's what my relatives felt. They must have just got shocked, mustn't they? When they came into Sydney Harbour, you know?
I think everyone would have been just totally, where am I?
The other journey that I think about a lot is the journey of Bennelong back to England. I mean, that one. Can you imagine when he landed what that was like? You know, and you just think it's very hard. People have all sorts of different experiences now, but not quite those ones where you just your whole universe totally turned upside down, you know?
That's right.
So
We even when we travel now, we know what to expect. But in those days, it would have been like going to another planet.
It really would have, yep.
That's Matt McMahon. Matt, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Thanks so much for having me on, Frank. It's great.